Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, John Karsibayev.
Thanks for having me, John, on the Ivy Podcast. I'm the CTO at Mogul Games, located in Miami, and you know, great to be here.
Awesome, Carl. Thanks so much for making time to talk to us this afternoon. Before we talk about your current role in the Mogul Games, give us a thumbnail version of your career to date, where you've been, what you've been up to.
Sure, absolutely. I guess we can start from the very beginning. You know, I was always into technology, games, and movies before I even knew what I really wanted to do. So I actually started by learning fine art and digital art, photography, filmmaking, computer animation, and some programming. So I was doing, you know, learning a lot of different things at, you know, at once and whatnot. I went to a few different colleges. Once I settled on computer animation, and then I actually became a freelance 3D character rigger. A lot of people might not know what it is, but it's basically like if you're making a 3D character for an animated movie or a video game, it's at first it's just like a sculpture standing, you know, with the hands, with the arms spread out to the sides. So you have to put in a skeleton and make it move and have nice deformations on the polygons when it's moving. So yeah, the 3D character rigger is responsible for doing all that and painting out the deformations and setting up controls so that the animators can just take it and then make it, you know, make it actually move, animate the character or an object, prop, anything like that. So that's what I was really into. It's not really an artistic role. So I did study computer animation in the end, but I did end up doing more of basically the most technical thing that there is in computer animation. And I also went into a stereoscopic conversion. Was basically helping to convert a lot of Marvel movies like Thor, Iron Man, and whatnot, into, you know, from the 2D versions to 3D versions, so people can, you know, watch them, enjoy them in the theaters with the glasses, you know, see them in 3D. I did some conversion and compositing for that, but then I really wanted to get into programming. You know, I started exploring that and I found that it's something that I actually enjoy the most. So I started, you know, expanding my rigging capabilities with automatic scripting, like in Maya, which is like the software used for computer animation. And so I set up a bunch of little auto scripts to help my rigging process. And then I learned that a lot of big riggers out there actually do that. And then I wanted to take it a step further. And I actually self-taught myself C#. And then I decided to dive deep into game development. And I was learning game development on the side, and I wanted to start a company. So I built a team of about 14 people over a few months, and I was leading the team. You know, everyone was pro bono, you know, just a group of friends and colleagues and whatnot, trying to make a 3D mobile game. So I was doing a lot of the work for it, all of the game dev, you know, the game design, art direction, programming, character rigging, and, you know, managing employees. Well, they're not really employees, but you could say employees. And just making sure that, you know, everyone works together, putting all the assets together and whatnot. And that was my big intro to game development world. And after learning all that, a local college, you know, learned about me, and they asked me to create a game development program for them. So I did that and I was teaching it myself. But then I actually got an actual programming job, which was my first official programming job as a developer I was working for this company called Evolution Ventures. They were in Miami at a time, but then they became kind of virtual and just, you know, everyone was everywhere. There was no office. People just moved out to different states or countries and whatnot. And yeah, so I was a C-sharp Unity developer. So even though they were not making games, but it was still right up my alley because it was still the, you know, the software that I like to use the most, which is used to make games as well. And I created over 70 applications for them and managed to close to 200 actually. They were all for high-end luxury, mostly high-rise real estate buildings. They were like sales presentation apps, you could call them. We would build like an iPad app, a PC app for like a PC touchscreen that they would put in a sales center, a big they would have like a huge screen, like a huge video wall, where we would load on our like companion, remotely controlled companion application that you could control either with a touch screen or the iPad. And these real estate agents would just, you know, like set up appointments with potential buyers and, you know, use the software to show off what the building will look like in the future when it's built and everything you would expect, you know, in a real estate application to have. So that's where I got a lot of experience, you know, in app development and C sharp and Unity and 3D and 2D. And I had a big hand in, you know, user experience and UI, not just development itself, and, you know, working with clients. And during that time, I also decided to build another game. This time it was only a team of myself and one of my friends, Taylor Selgas. He's actually a really good designer based in Colorado right now. So we built this game called Bunny Taxi. It's like a 2D cartoony game where you're a bunny and you kind of have this screen on a homepage where it's like Uber and it tells you when there's a ride request. And, you know, you hop in and you go pick up other bunnies and you have to drive them to their destination. But there are like bad bunnies running at you, shooting at you, you know, this cartoony shooting, not really real, but yeah. And you have to basically like squash them or shoot them with a carrot, you know, not real violence, just in a cartoony. And yeah, get to the destination. So that was that game. And that was the point actually when John Oringer found me. You know, the founder of Shutterstock, also the founder of one of the founders of Mogul Games. That was before Mogul Games existed, but then everything happened really quickly. So John found me on LinkedIn and, you know, we had a call and then I went to meet him up. And the same day I spoke to his partner, Edward Lando, and they hired me. You know, they offered me to be the CTO of Mogul Games. And next thing you know, within a few weeks, you know, I was building the company from scratch. Mogul Games, making mobile games.
Wow, that's super cool. What a story. Thanks for the background. So fast forward, you mentioned you've met John on LinkedIn, which seems pretty unusual. But in these days, with everything being fully remote and virtual, I guess that's not very surprising. Yeah. Tell us a little bit more about how did that conversation go initially? What would you guys discuss? Is just riffing on gaming ideas and found some synergies? Just tell us a little bit more about that experience.
Yeah, it was actually, it all happened so quickly. I was just minding my own business, watching Netflix with my girlfriend after work or something like that. And I'm pretty quick. I'm very responsive. So if I, you know, I see a notification or message email, I usually get on right on top of that. And so I saw a message on LinkedIn. You know, I'm used to getting a lot of them, you know, from recruiters. Yeah. I thought it was just another recruiter. And then I'm like, so I pressed on it. And I'm like, wait, that's John Oringer from Shutterstock. Mm-hmm. I was kind of in a little shock. And then he said that he'd like to, you know, he was asking about my experience. And it was a very short conversation. And then he was just like, do you just want to take it to a video chat? And I'm like, sure. So he sent me a link. And we hopped on Zoom And then, you know, he shared his idea that he wants to build a mobile game company in Miami, you know, to be a part of Miami tech scene, and if I was interested. And he told me a little bit about his idea. And then I sent over Bunny Taxi for him to check out, and he loved it, and he invited me to his home the very next day. So we spoke, and the same day, then I spoke to Edward Lando, and then I think the same day or the very next morning, like, they were like, yeah, this is the offer, and let's do it. I'm like, awesome. it was very quick. Yeah.
Well, that's awesome. That sounds super exciting, and how things happen so fast. And, you know, that's great. That's great to hear. So I guess, to the extent that you can share about Mogul Games, what are you guys working on? What's the vision there?
Yeah, I can't say too much, but you know, we literally just started out like a little bit over 2 months ago. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're building a casual mobile game that, we think has a lot of potential. You know, it's right up the alley with all the other really popular mobile games, but we think we have a little bit better ideas and more things that might appeal to more audiences than what they're doing.
All right.
Well, yeah, at least that's what we're hoping for.
Great suspense building there, Carl. So that's awesome. What's the timeline? When can we expect to see that hit the stores?
Yeah. So it's going to be, you know, just like you'd expect any other mobile game. It's going to be free to play on Android and iOS. We're hoping to release it at the very beginning of October this year.
Oh, okay. Oh, wow. So that's just around the corner. That's crazy. So
yeah, it's not a super complicated game. You know, it's 2D. That's why it basically cuts a lot of the development time.
Yeah.
Because 3D games would take way longer to do. But right. Since it's 2D, and it does have a back end, so we do have a back end developer. It's not simple to the point where you don't even need a back end for it. So there is a back end, but it's still manageable, you know, within the time frame.
Mm-hmm. Right,
but
right.
I can definitely say that it's going to have a lot of beautiful art.
I can only imagine. That's super cool. Just in the gaming industry in general is just such a, at least for me, it's been a very interesting trend as an angel investor and part of, you know, few syndicates. A lot of deals that, you know, I've invested or I've kind of doing the due diligence all around the gaming, which is for me personally is, you know, very exciting. What are your overall thoughts on just the different trends in the gaming industry? What have you observed lately? What do you think is kind of the next big thing from that perspective?
I don't know if there's a next big thing really coming or what it could be, but you know, it's pretty exciting how it all went from just like basic like gaming on like old school consoles to PC gaming, and then all of a sudden, you know, the iPhone comes out and we have everyone, you know, ages, you know, 3 through 85 playing or older games here and there, you know, just casually on their phones. So it's like gaming became this big thing where people might not think like they're gaming, but they are, like someone playing, you know, Candy Crush here and there or something else, I don't know. But the fact that a lot of the games today are on the phones and they're casual and they're free to play, you know, it opens big doors, you know, for the market and the industry. So that's, you know, that's why it exploded. There are a lot of, you know, mobile games out there today. But I'm also, you know, really excited about the other side of this, which is the realism of PC games. So, you know, the high end AAA games. Pretty sure, you know, within a few decades, we won't be able to tell what's reality and what's not. You know, like Elon Musk said, maybe we are in a simulation.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I can definitely relate with my 8-year-old just starting dabbing into games, and I'm trying to shift him from just playing the games to actually get into some type of like building the games. he's been taking some courses on like the game design or game building, like in Roblox or things like that. But it's amazing how these platforms have basically now created the almost like an ecosystem of just, you know, opportunities to monetize, to build games, to, you know, the whole the cryptocurrency space with Robux and all of the individual currencies within the games. I think that's super cool. There's so much opportunity there, very exciting times. So yeah. The other question that I always ask a lot of my guests on Ivy Podcast is, good portion of our listeners, so it's half and half, is executives themselves who are running the companies, but also the other spectrum are the early stage career professionals. So those just entering the workforce or, you know, second year MBAs, they're on that cusp deciding what to do, whether, you know, start their own companies or go corporate route. So for anyone considering, you know, just gaming industry in general as a career path, what would you give your 21-year-old self as you graduate in college in terms of investing further as far as developing certain skill sets?
It's really split into three categories, I'd say. The first one is the same that, you know, applies to any business, which is the business part. You know, you need the investment, you need the idea, you need some kind of business plan. So that's number one. The other two are very different. One is art and the other one is, you know, development, the programming. So it's two completely different worlds. It usually doesn't apply in the tech industry because it's usually just all tech. And, you know, you have UI designers here and there who are also, you know, user experience designers who have some kind of, you know, like, you know, insight on the tech as well. But in games, a lot of the employees in the game industry are artists. And, it really depends on, you know, which side you're on. There's plenty of work on both sides, but I feel like the industry is really saturated with, artists. I kind of try to go that route myself a little bit, even though I was more on the techie side of things, but I saw how difficult it is to break into this industry as an artist, whether it's movies or games. You basically have to be the Da Vinci of this time. The talent needs to be extreme an extremely high level. And, you know, you need to have experience and this and that. There's a lot of competition out there for art, I'd say. The crazy part is that it's not really that well paid, just because, you know, supply and demand. There's so much supply, but I guess not so much demand. The programmers, it's the same thing like in any other industry, gaming or web development, app development. That's probably still, you know, less, you know, jobs available for programmers in gaming than in other industries, especially web development, because that's like most of the tech out there is, you know, it's just web, you know, like React, Node today. If I, you know, 21-year-old myself, if I was, you know, I am on the tech side more, I'd say, even though I do like art and I understand it and I like to critique it, but I'd probably say, you know, dive deeper and sooner into, you know, learning, you know, as much as possible about computer science and different things that, different things that, you know, correlate to game development and whatnot, you know, just learning, you know, 3D math, especially because that's very important in games, especially 3D games.
Right.
I think that's.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. No, that's those are great recommendations. And I think in general, just picking up on some of the technical skills early on, laying that foundation to be able to, you know, at least, read and understand the overall infrastructure in place. And then from there on out, diversify and build a little bit more the artistic side, I guess. That's just to summarize that recommendation, which is, I think, is spot on. So you've mentioned you've developed many games yourself. Talk to us a little bit about the process, that creative process of how do you even come up with an idea for a game? Like, is it just spur of the moment, or is it just, do you have some type of a process in place? Tell us a little bit more about that.
It's really hard, you know, to carve a new path and expect to be successful. Obviously it's been done, but usually that requires a very tremendous, you know, investment, with a polished idea that can be verified by multiple experienced people in the market, you know, from CEOs to marketing people and whatnot. So, the path that I approach, and, you know, a lot of other successful gaming companies approach, is that, you know, look for things that are already out there that are successful, and, you know, adapt them to your own idea, and, you know, make them unique in their own way, but while still following similar business models, because, you know, they've been proven to work and profitable. Most indie game developers will probably disagree with me to an extreme level, because I know how it is. It's all about passion in the indie game world, you know, coming up with something completely brand new. But, you know, when trying to be a successful business, it's all need to be based on the numbers, not just, you know, the free flowing creativity and passion, which you still need, obviously, when you're doing the work. But it all needs to start with the business idea, and, you know, it needs to be viable. You know, the scope matters a lot as well. What is your investment compared to what the project scope is? So you kind of have to see where you want to land, and then see what you're working with, and collab from there.
That's very interesting. And which brings me to another point that we discuss on this podcast a lot, is around innovation, really building and fostering that culture of innovation early on, regardless if you're a startup or if you're established organization. That need for continuous innovation is always there, especially, I would imagine, with the games, continuous iteration, continuous innovation. What are your strategies there? What's helping you build and foster that type of environments for yourself, for your teammates and colleagues to succeed and continuously innovate?
Yeah, that's, you know, something that we talk about a lot during our meetings. You know, I always tell my employees to just always try to think outside the box, you know, look for references, you know, what's been done, what's out there, and, you know, find the best examples and try to improve on them and change them up and to make them unique in our own way. And always, you know, try to push to the next level. Don't just settle on something that's, you know, already been done. Always try to improve it and come up with something that might feel similar, but it looks different and behaves a little bit differently. But, you know, you can't always just come out with something completely brand new, because people today are used to specific, you know, user experiences. So you still have to stick to specific, you know, structures for the user interface design and then things like that, and how things behave.
Right. No, absolutely. And it's, you know, also the whole perception of innovation, that it's not, doesn't necessarily always has to be so grandiose and earth shattering. Mm-hmm. Innovation could be in the form of an experiment, which, you know, one of my favorite books is by a former Harvard professor, Stefan Tomke. He wrote these two exceptional pieces on experimentation works and experimentation matters. Kind of really how to build that environment all around experiments. So that's kind of always resonates with when we have the conversation as such. The other side I wanted to touch upon is when you that early stage building the company with not a brand to itself, and you're still establishing that, and for you to be able to attract the top talent to your organization. I've been there myself as a founder operator of multiple startups, a lot of which I have successfully failed. But one of the critical components of a great operator is ability to recruit, right? And build a team of, you know, like-minded, you know, people that bring different strengths. How do you go about that? What are your strategies there to really attract the top talent?
First I try to get as many, applications as possible, and then go through them very thoroughly. I know it's a very exhausting and tedious process. And, if it's an artist that I'm trying to hire, and I would get my art lead involved and get opinion on specific, portfolio pieces and whatnot. And then we would narrow it down to like the top people that we would like to talk to. And, I always like to talk about, the ambitious goals that we have set for the company, to get the interest of the applicant, because obviously if the applicant, has a lot of value, is very talented, they probably have multiple offers and, it's not easy to lock them down that quickly. We definitely show our ambitious goals and make them feel super welcome. We have a very casual environment, very friendly, and we're very free about how we work. We don't have strict work hours. I like to tell everyone, work hard, play hard. I don't care if you work at 4 o'clock in the morning or if you work at noon, regular five, 9 to 5, as long as, you do your work and, you get it done on time and it's great and everybody loves it, then that's all that matters. And at the same time, I like to challenge people and make them feel important, so that they can, keep growing and, feel appreciated. Those are the things that I like to concentrate on. Definitely when recruiting, my biggest things is just to show our ambition and how supportive and welcome we are and friendly.
Mm-hmm. Right, absolutely. No, those are great strategies. And I think having that passion for whatever the mission that you have always resonates with people that you talk to. So I think that's also kind of important element as you try to recruit. Mm-hmm. From your standpoint, staying up to date on the industry trends and self-actualization and learning opportunities, what is your content diet is looking like? Share with us the sources that you consume on a daily basis to stay informed. And how do you also filter with so much information available being thrown at us? How selective are you, and what helps you actually be so selective that you let your mind be exposed to only information that you find valuable?
Absolutely. Yeah. Actually, my content diet is not just about tech. It's pretty mixed. As far as tech, I like to read tech posts on LinkedIn or different tech outlet posts, even on Facebook, there's a lot, everyone's on Facebook, right? So everyone's posting. So I come across a lot of articles on Facebook. And I also really love YouTube. You can find almost anything on there, right? From science to just blabber and regular YouTubers and vloggers and whatnot. I'm really into science and tech and medicine and even supplementation. So those are the things that I like to follow. And it really, really gets me, in the zone, and I can just zone out and, spend hours sometimes at night going from one to the next. Yeah, sometimes I even forget that I've seen something, 6 months later, it's like, oh, here it is again. I sometimes I feel like, my girlfriend tells me that my content diet, I need to go on a diet from the content diet. That's something that's a bit too much.
That's why they call it the diet, right?
Right.
No, that's pretty cool. I love that framework. I think it's just keeping it very diverse, in a sense that, day to day, we do so much within our own bubbles, but trying to expose yourself to something that's completely outside of that spectrum could also be very beneficial. And last but not least, what are you currently reading in terms of a book, or is there a book that you always recommend to others, and why is that?
Books are something that I never got to love, because it's bothering me mentally. It's completely against my personality. I'm the type of person that needs to finish things that I start like immediately. If I know that I have tasks waiting for me, I can barely sleep at night. So if I could finish a book in a few hours, then it's cool. But otherwise, I try not to get myself involved in that process because my content diet is already taking up too much of my time and my sleep already.
So you like to focus more on some, you know, shorter pieces, something that you can actually consume, you know, right away. Because with books, yeah, I agree. It's an investment. It's a commitment. And I can definitely relate to that. So far, you know, all the books lately that I've written, maybe one or two out of 100 that I actually finished. Every single one of them is just basically, you know, it's could be condensed into probably an article. So that's kind of, I definitely relate to kind of what you talk
about. Yeah, that's what I prefer as well. Like when I just want the main sauce, right? Just give me the main, because if you read a book, you might obviously learn, you know, a bunch of things, but there are probably only like a few the, you know, most important things that you take away from it. So
yeah, for sure. I've lately been a great fan of like Blinkist that gives you the highlights and tidbits.
I was just about to mention that. I actually installed it, but I never got to open it. But I just I might get into it. I might get lost in it. I eat up new information very quickly, and I love it, and I can't stop.
For sure. I was skeptical originally about it, but it's actually pretty cool. I've been a fan, but for sure. Carl, can't thank you enough for your time today. Very short, but very insightful conversation. What I love doing with a lot of the guests on the podcast is do another recording in about a year and see how much have changed and transpired since the last time we spoke. Revisit the conversation a year ago and see how much actually has changed since then. So I'm definitely looking forward to doing that with you.
Absolutely. That would be great. You know, I would love to be on the podcast in a year.
That's awesome. Thanks so much.
I'm sure a lot of things will change because we just started out.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Definitely looking forward to that.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.